Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is a People's Question Time, hosted by Roderick Gates. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a busy week, and I'll be reviewing over the next 10 minutes or so the latest developments internationally and any significant domestic issues from the US to the UK. Oh, in the US Congress, President Bush has found himself facing mountable opposition to his troop surge in Iraq, not altogether surprising considering the massive casualties on the part of U.S. soldiers and their families. In the U.K., British Prime Minister Tony Blair is seeing one of his major aides arrested on possible involvement in bribery for peerages being appointed to the British upper house in return for loyalty to the Prime Minister to vote as he declares. In Darfur, the crisis in Darfur continues. I don't know if George Clooney's efforts to secure international attention that goes beyond just pressuring the gangsters going on their murderous rampage will make much difference, since the amount of refugees hasn't declined, at least none that I can find. And the Indonesian issue with Aceh appears to have faded, though that's without violence. That's the same with the Kurdish separation question. And interestingly, as those outside the US, considering the insulation of the American population by the US press, that turned Turkish reporter, who's reported on the Armenian genocide, which he called it, so has recently been, I guess we could call, assassinated. His killer is suspected to be in custody now and has said he doesn't regret it. On the Canadian side, the French socialist presidential candidate made some comments about Quebec in response to a question, something along the lines of, we recognize them as a worthwhile nation of the world, something which has stung quite a few people. And the Canadian Prime Minister rebuked her, telling her to mind her own business, in a manner of speaking. In Lebanon, unfortunately, chaos has once again sprung as the Maronite Christian militias launched themselves against very peaceful demonstrations in Beirut, clearly to cause trouble, of which they've caused over a number of days now. The Lebanese Prime Minister was in Paris at the time, meeting with Jacques Chirac and the other European leaders to discuss financial and other aid, and has found himself in a bit of an embarrassment. Just as he left, some might know, he said, "Don't ruin the country just as I leave, please." And in the West Bank, more violence continues despite the near ceasefire achieved between Hamas and Fatah, which have been waging a small civil war, especially in Gaza, not just in the West Bank, but in Gaza too, while at the same time the Israelis took advantage of it to raid Gaza once more to capture many or kill many suspected militants. They can't be bothered to exercise faith in the Palestinian authorities to arrest any criminals. They go in and attack the residents of these suspected criminals themselves. and just call it targeted killing. Israel's policy of targeted killing in the West Bank and Gaza is not new, and notoriously more than just the target die. In Iraq, we see, unfortunately, still more killing, and not just by the occupation forces in Iraq, but also by the jihadists that have come to hijack the occupation of Iraq. The Turkish forces stationed in southeastern Turkey, I'm not talking about the crushing of the Kurds in southeastern Turkey, but with the approaching possible conflict with Iran. At the moment, ever since November, December of last year, as has been reported by Newsweek in the US, the Times in London, a huge naval strike force led by the USS Abraham Lincoln is positioned in the Indian Ocean, possibly, it would appear, for an attack on Iran. Now, with the huge quagmire in Iraq and the overstretching of US forces, I doubt we are going to witness an invasion, more like strategic attacks, like in Iraq in 1998 by Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, striking at significant nuclear and military locations and targets in Iran. However, George Bush at one point in Germany, when visiting Chancellor Merkel in Berlin, gave us a sort of mixed message by saying the idea that we're going to attack Iran is just stupid speculation. That being said, all options are on the table. Ladies and gentlemen, the Iranian defense forces, I guess I could politely put it that way, as well as ordinary militias of the kind that Switzerland has, would be able to very quickly turn Iran into another quagmire for the US, and they know that. The Pentagon knows that. That's why they only recommend a naval assault as well as air assault. Whereas in Australia, it's mostly local news. We've had Australia Day, a few awards, including Australian of the Year, who went to one environmentalist who the ABC, our national broadcast, interestingly described as it was once a radical, because they didn't say compared to whom was he a radical. I mean, maybe compared to the current Prime Minister of Australia, who gave him the award, and not compared to most ordinary Australians if their view comes into account. In Yugoslavia, or what's left of it, Serbian nationalists have, you know, some might recall a man that we executed, or charged, sorry, Slobodan Milosevic, well, his party has just resurged to power in surprising the European Union with their vitriolic. They talk about Kosovo always being in Yugoslavia, as well as not joining NATO, no doubt, for the usual reasons. Ladies and gentlemen, I think I'm just about done with an opening statement. If any of you wish to call to extend either what I've just mentioned or on issues that have arisen recently in your country or internationally, please call on the phone numbers provided on the homepage of BBS Radio. Could our first caller begin speaking, if he's ready? I'm not hearing anything on our end. Well, on the Kosovo tragedy in 1999, many recall that Bush and Clinton began their war against Yugoslavia, supposedly on the pretext that ethnic cleansing was occurring. Well, as usual, we like to talk about how we were lied to over Iraq and the some extent Afghanistan. Well, the same was in Kosovo. There was no record at all, at least none that is undisputed, about ethnic cleansing in Kosovo pre-March 1999. The same as the WMDs weren't there. In March 1999, the United Kingdom and United States Air Forces, under the cover of the framework of NATO, launched an air bombing campaign in Yugoslavia. The air campaign is recorded as extending until June and destroying not just military targets but civilian soft targets, as well as the NATO campaign is subject to positive pronouncements in Western scholarship and televised debates, almost universally in massive support for what was plainly a war of aggression against Yugoslavia, something the Nuremberg Tribunal condemned as the supreme international crime for which Nazi war criminals were either jailed or hanged for. Well, the UN human rights monitors were in position just before the war, and they were told to leave by Bill Clinton. Well, the UN monitors chairman stated, I'm quoting, there is no humanitarian disaster. There was one recorded after the bombing began. April onwards, that's when the 1 million Kosovar Albanians fled, not before. Beforehand, it was up to around 2,000 dead, mostly Calais guerrillas and Yugoslav forces. However, no Yugoslav forces were in Kosovo. In a manner of speaking, the KLA had driven out Slobodan Milosevic and his forces and hence wasn't able to carry out ethnic cleansing because they would have been caught as well by the human rights monitors. So in Europe, it's peaceful now, much the way it was in the Balkans pre-March 1999, though rightly, concern is expressed in European capitals about the implications of the Serb nationalists winning power again. Vladimir Putin, here's an interesting thing, has sold engaged in a new phase of selling anti-aircraft mobile vans, which will be very effective in repelling air attacks. The Russian defense minister, I don't think it was in Tehran, well, he held a press conference, I saw it on France 24, saying, well, they can only be used for defensive purposes, so why shouldn't we sell them to the Iranians? That will no doubt beefen up Iranian defense. However, the Iranian theocracy is no doubt strengthened by the clouds of war hanging around just because they're pursuing a civilian nuclear program. Note, we have no evidence, even now, that they're pursuing a nuclear weapons program, only nuclear energy, something which the British Prime Minister Tony Blair is no doubt familiar with since he's announced his intention to expand Britain's energy based on nuclear power, as well as upgrade our nuclear arsenal to Trident in defiance of the British public and parliament. And George W. Bush is interested in expanding to tactical nukes. Speaking of which, to tactical nukes, there has been leaks over the last 2 months about Israel at least planning to use tactical nukes against Iran. Well, if that means not just one mushroom cloud rising in Tehran every time there's a missile hit, but also from the nuclear target as well. I don't think that's productive. The BBC notoriously has been silent in regards to the clouds hanging around Iran. I know from this personal experience, as I've been in personal communication with Mr. Reynolds, and the world correspondent for the BBC, has been generally resistant to news reports about Iran. On one occasion, he said, "We do take notice." And I replied, "Yeah, you take notice, but you don't cover. There's a difference." Belarus, Russian as well as European gas problem was quickly overcome after Vladimir Putin visited the Belarus president. And considering the way he's dealt with a number of oligarchs in the Russian Federation, no doubt Mr. Putin was quite harsh towards the Belarus president, telling him not to sell excess oil. He's provided the oil to send, and as well as the gas to send to Europe, not make a private profit out of, which is the reason why Russia cut off the gas supply. The friendship line, as it's called, that runs from, I think it's just out of Kyiv through all the way to Germany, as well as a separate connection to France. The world's energy dependence on oil, gas, is once again being identified, as well as this event serves as a warning that Russia is not a trustworthy source of energy, especially to its main consumers in Europe. That's why the Germans are moving away from nuclear power, but also focusing on developing their own separate energy sector, as well as fuel. In the Middle East, there's not too much of news except the continued violence in Beirut. The Christian militia, once they began their attack on the Hezbollah-led demonstrations, brought probably let the genie out of the bowl. They got what they provoked, what they didn't intend. Wide-scale violence, not just by Hezbollah and their Christian allied militia, in retaliation, but all the other groups in Beirut, as well as throughout Lebanon. Literally everyone, kind of like the descent, Australian descent to Cronulla, in the Cronulla Beach, just in Queensland, descended upon Beirut at the first sign of this Christian troublemaking in Beirut. And the Lebanese Prime Minister finds himself embarrassed. Maybe a return to the country finding himself not the leader of it anymore. And the demands of Hezbollah are not unreasonable, at least not to me. If any of you have an opinion on that, you can call us, I'm sure. The phone numbers are on the website of BBS Radio. And I have the numbers here, ladies and gentlemen. The toll-free number is 877-876-5227. For the US, for Canada, it is 888-810-8322. And the direct international number is 530-876-3222. If you have any email, if you wish to email issues or questions, please email us at rhod2002@yahoo.com.au. And in China, the People's Liberation Army isn't very interested in liberating what are described as Chinese in the northwest, but are being treated much like the Kurds in southeastern Turkey. But that's not discussed by the Western media or by Western leaders, like when they visit Beijing. It's not as bad a situation as in Tibet, which is still under Chinese occupation since the invasion in 1957, though the Dalai Lama has now conceded that he does not support Tibetan separation from China, just more autonomy from the butchers of Beijing, I don't know if that's the politest way to put it, but I can put it more viciously. The Northern Irish issue has arisen again, but this time not because of a huge surge of violence. We now since 2 days ago, the last final confirmation that the RUC, the police force in Northern Ireland, has collaborated with the Protestant and Unionist militias in their own murderous terrorist campaign, not necessarily directed from London, but the ordinary Northern Irish policemen assisting Protestant and Unionist terrorists in killing civilians. And this is huge. I think she is the Northern Irish Police Commissioner. Well, she immediately held a press conference saying she didn't like it, but they admit it now. And this is huge. This is something that has been in the wings ever since the 1970s in the suspicious Black Thursday massacre, because there seemed to be a great deal of collaboration between the unionists and the police. It looked very suspicious, though the grievances of the Republicans in Northern Ireland were not taken seriously. Our two listeners who have called, you can begin speaking, and to those who haven't called yet, our number, our toll-free number is 877-876-5227. For the US and Canada, it's 48-10-83-22. And the direct international number is 530-876-3222. All right, ladies and gentlemen, just waiting for the first caller. The Triumph Force, Hezbollah over Israel, as some might recall, involved bunkers. Well, that's not too surprising, since in a manner of speaking, they knew that an attack was going to be launched by the IDF forces. There was a leak almost a month after the July conflict against Hezbollah that the Israeli military forces were planning ahead for an attack anyway. They were just looking for an excuse in the capture of two Israeli soldiers. We don't know whether Hezbollah had to cross the Lebanese-Israeli border or not, but after capturing him, that was used as an excuse. However, the U.S. doesn't really have an excuse to condemn international terrorism. It's been involved in a great deal of international terrorism itself. Washington's support for Saddam Hussein reached such an extreme that it was even willing to overlook an Iraqi Air Force attack on the USS Stark, killing 37 of its crew, a privilege otherwise enjoyed only by Israel. In the case of the USS Liberty, it was Washington's decisive support for Saddam, well after the crimes that now so shock the administration and U.S. Congress, that led to Iranian capitulation to Baghdad and Washington, as Dilip Hero concludes in his History of the Iran-Iraq War. The two allies had coordinated their military operations against Tehran. The shooting down of an Iranian civilian airliner by the guided missile cruiser Vincennes was the culmination of Washington's diplomatic and military economic campaign in support of Saddam. Well, there was a proxy army in Nicaragua. We'll see whether or not another one is launched, unfortunately. That followed Washington's orders in the 1980s to attack soft targets, such as farm cooperatives and health clinics, instead of trying to duke it out with the Sandinistas directly, attack a lot of schools, health centers, and those sort of things, so that the Nicaraguan government cannot provide social services for the peasants, cannot develop its project, as explained by General John Galvin, commander of the U.S. Southern Command, who added that with these tactics, aimed at civilians lacking means of defense against armed terrorist bands, prospects for the Contras would improve. Testifying before the House Foreign Affairs Western Hemisphere Committee, Galvin said, "The Contras have a fighting chance if we sustain them with continued military aid. It's getting better in the past few months. I'm more hopeful than I was before." After the hearing what the Contras have achieved in the past few months, Galvin replied, "Lots of victories. They're going after soft targets. They're not trying to duke it out with their Sandinistas." And when the former CIA director, Stansfield Turner, testified before the U.S. Congress in April 1985, was asked to define U.S. intervention in Nicaragua, he described it as, I'm quoting, state-sponsored terrorism. We could take a more recent example, like in August 1998, where a stupid and cruel and cynical raid by Bill Clinton in Khartoum was committed. I'm quoting Christopher Hitchens here, British author. "I speak with some feeling about that latter event because I wrote a Free Nation columns about it at the time, pointing out with some evidence that goes unrebutted today that it was a war crime, and a war crime opposed by the majority of the military and intelligence establishment. The crime was directly and sordidly linked to the effort by a crooked president to avoid impeachment, a conclusion seditiously avoided by the Democrats nowadays. The Al Shifa pharmaceutical plant was well known to be a civilian target, and its selection was opposed by most of the Joint Chiefs and many CIA personnel for just this reason. The U.S. State Department is not opposed to terrorism except when committed by the U.S. and will describe the acts of other states or groups as terrorism when they do it, not when the U.S. does it. It is important to be aware of the profound commitment of Western elite opinion to the repression of freedom and democracy throughout the world by violence if necessary. To understand our own cultural world, we must recognize that the advocacy of terrorism is clear, explicit, and principled across the elite U.S. political spectrum. Little changes as we move to the what's described as the establishment left, to borrow the term used by foreign policy editor Charles Maines. Consider political commentator Mark Kinsley, who represents the left in mainstream U.S. commentary and television debate. He's associate editor, for The Guardian in Britain nowadays. And when the U.S. Department of State publicly confirmed the U.S. policy of terrorist attacks on soft targets, meaning civilian targets, in Nicaragua in the 1980s, Kinsley wrote that we should not be too quick to condemn this official policy. International terrorist operations doubtless cause vast civilian suffering, he conceded, but they may be perfectly legitimate. The policy is sensible if cost-benefit analysis shows that the amount of blood and misery that will be poured in yields democracy, in the conventional sense of the term. I don't know if Osama bin Laden has ever described jihadist terrorism as perfectly legitimate. It's a pretty complimentary phrase, but Michael Kinsley does. He's still alive, and he's still regarded in high reverence, both in the U.S. and the U.K. In response to an article he wrote, something about capitalism and potatoes, where he sort of justified the U.S. economic system, something to do with potatoes, I don't recall. It was about a month ago, I immediately did a reply, because he used the phrase capitalist to describe the U.S. economic system, which is a pretty big joke. I know where he thinks most of the U.S. military hardware in the U.S. is produced. What does he think the Pentagon is? It's not a charity organization. The U.S. is the most state-run economy in the world. If you think the USSR had a state-run economy, well, the U.S. has a much bigger one. the U.S. as a mixed economy, not a capitalist economy. If you do an economics class in the U.S., you will be told that the U.S. does not have a capitalist economy, it has a mixed economy. Europeans use other phrases like social market or social democracy, as well as the phrase welfare state, though that extends to other government policies like social welfare and state services, which the U.S. is a leaner, meaner version of. For those still listening, there is even more reason to doubt the U.S. priorities in Iran as sincere and opposing a nuclear weapons program, the same as there was in regards to WMDs in Iran. United Nations Resolution 687 calls for a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East. Well, that resolution has been in existence for a long time. And the number one WMD proliferator in the region of the Middle East is Israel. We've known that by confirmation by the bravery of Mr. Mordecai Vanunu since the 1980s, in 1987, when he broke the news to the world in what has been interestingly described as the world's biggest secret, or the world's best-known secret, sorry, in regards to Israel's WMD program. Now, if there have been any private pressures on the part of the Americans or the British, remember that the Israelis even stole plutonium from British in order to pursue nuclear weapons. If there's been any private pressure, well, it doesn't appear to have been effective. The Negev Center in the Negev Desert of Israel is still in existence. There is a no-fly zone covering the Negev Research Center, is its full name. Only the Prime Minister, the Defense Minister, and chosen aides may visit the Negev Center and get a tour of the central control room. To listeners who want to call, our toll-free number is 877-876-5227. For the U.S. and Canada, 4810-8322. The direct international number, if you have any issues or questions that you want to raise, is 530-876-3222. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is People's Question Time with Roger Gates. In October 23rd, there was an edition of Time magazine which caught my attention. I responded to it because of an interesting quote that I found, that JFO McAllister and Sally B. Donnelly made an untruthful statement where they said, a fortiori, the original hope of the US, Britain, and allies to install a democratic government in Iraq. Well, that can't possibly be true. Last time I checked, they were talking about WMDs, and I sent them a letter to the editor of Time magazine for a correction. This is October of last year. Still no correction, certainly no response to me, since looks like Time magazine can't be bothered to correct themselves. Here are a number of quotes that should be familiar to those who don't have a bad memory. On the 25th of March 2003, the British Prime Minister Tony Blair declared, I have always said to people throughout that our aim has not been regime change. Our aim has been the elimination of weapons of mass destruction. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell expressed agreement, saying there is no other question. The sole question is whether or not Saddam Hussein has disarmed the weapons of mass destruction. However, that is the argument made, which all the colleagues that were willing to pay attention to were not the obvious hope of establishing permanent military bases in the heart of the Gulf region in the country with the second biggest oil reserves in the world. I note Times' refusal to recognise this, however public it may be. What's revealing and important to the future is that Washington's display of contempt of democracy went side by side with a chorus of adulation about its yearning for democracy. To be able to carry that off is an impressive achievement, hard to mimic even in North Korea. Iraqis have some insight into this process of conquerors and conquered. Right after the First World War, the British replaced the Turks as the rulers of Iraq. They occupied the country and faced, as one report says, an imperialist agitation. From the start, a revolt became widespread. The British felt it wise to put up a facade. Lord Curzon, the British Foreign Secretary, said Britain wanted to create an Arab facade, ruled and administered under British guidance and controlled by a native Mohammedan, and as far as possible by an Arab staff. Actually, Lord Curzon was very honest in those days. It was an Arab facade, and they went on. Britain would rule behind a veil of constitutional fictions, like a buffer state and various other terms, but it would basically be a facade. And that's the way Britain ran the region after the First World War. So the huge rebellion in Iraq almost immediately after the March 2003 invasion is not unusual. The British faced an immediate rebellion in the interwar period. Throughout history, even the harshest and most shameful measures are regularly accompanied by professions of noble intent and rhetoric about bestowing freedom and independence. An honest look would only generalize Thomas Jefferson's observation on the world situation of his day. We believe no more in Bonaparte's merely fighting for the liberties of the seas than in Great Britain's fighting for the liberties of mankind. The object is the same, to draw to themselves the power, the wealth, and resources of other nations. In response to the article that I read by Michael Kinsley on the Clinton vision, I thought was the best recommendation for Michael Kinsley to read about if he was interested in facts and not theories. The US did not respond positively to the re-election of Mr. Ortega as president of Nicaragua lately, though the rest of the region did, in Latin America and Central America. The newly re-elected Nicaraguan president was greeted by the Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez. And domestically, I just read yesterday that he has re-established universal health care and universal education in Nicaragua. Well, this is quite extraordinary and has been long overdue. I'm sure that ordinary Americans would love to have both. There was, in the Cold War period, an opposition to Third World development, including former European colonies, by the US. It wasn't just from the 1980s onwards, the neoliberal policies, but also opposition to third world economic development. There is the US opposition to Indian independence and then post-independence development of India. For example, Robert J. McMahon's The Cold War on the Periphery in the United States, India, and Pakistan, published by the New York Columbia Press, where there's discussion between high US officials, meaning the cabinet, possibly even involving Richard Nixon, this is in the 70s, discussing their opposition to India's independence and quoting the remarks that Nehru, the first Indian Prime Minister, was a spoiled child, vain and immature, a hypersensitive egotist, motivated by a terrible resentment of domination by whites, intellectually arrogant, and of course at the same time suffering from an inferiority complex, schizophrenia, and while Indians are notably prone to blame others for their problems, as the British know all too well, and Indian ingratitude is due to a sense of divine right that is the sort of natural attribute of Indians. Oh, that's the traditional imperialist attitudes to current or former colonies. Bill O'Reilly's attitude to the Iraqis is not much different. Bill O'Reilly, the current host of the O'Reilly Factor on Fox News Channel, I recently watched last week, where he talked about his visit to Iraq. Of course, he only visited the troops. He didn't visit the slums of Baghdad or to Crete. He visited the troops and expressed his dismay at the lack of appreciation on the part of the Iraqis for the so-called liberation of their country, saying he didn't have respect for them, they haven't stood up. Well, one could say the same about the Americans during the War of Independence. Perhaps it would have been best if they didn't wage a war of independence against Britain. And look what they've done to the world. How ungrateful they are. They talk about how free they are, how better they are as a nation, how the world benefits from U.S. influence worldwide. They're so ungrateful to their British heritage. They scream about laws they inherited, the blasphemy law against freedom of speech, etc., etc. In fact, there was one story about 2 years ago on the O'Reilly Factor regarding some law, I believe it was the blasphemy law, where of course, where Bill O'Reilly expressed his indignation at the British legacy of law and order that included the host of laws that the US declared independence from but still inherited. Well, that's not you. Of the turning back to the issue of third world development, which continues in defiance of the 2002 Doha round that the leading Western states wish to impose literally over the heads of the third world countries that overwhelmingly rejected the Doha round. The New York Times had published articles like from J. Anthony Lucas in Mrs. Gandhi and the Left. Criticism by Menon reflects her drift to pragmatism. New York Times, 29th of April, this is 1996, where it says, the government of India has granted easy terms to private foreign investors in the fertilizer industry, is thinking about decontrolling several more industries, and is ready to liberalize import policy if it gets sufficient foreign aid. Much of what is happening now is a result of steady pressure from the United States and the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. The United States pressure in particular has been highly effective here because the United States provides by far the largest part of the foreign exchange needed to finance India's development and keep the wheels of industry turning. Call them strings, call them conditions, or whatever one likes. India has little choice now but to agree to many of the terms that the United States, through the World Bank, is putting on its aid. For India simply has nowhere else to turn. The 1980s is regarded in Central America and Latin America as the lost decade to the massive imposition of neoliberal policies. Well, from India it was 1996 onwards. And the New York Times article that I quoted from April 1966 just shows it was through coercion, but through foreign aid, through the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. Interestingly, the paper of the establishment left that complained about call them strings, call them conditions, or whatever one likes, because the New York Times isn't any more left-wing than the Spectator in Britain. There is also David K. Willis's Indo-US Relations Strained by Political Complexities and the Christian Science motto of in the same year, November 26, 1996, which is quite interesting. The White House does not consider that New Delhi is doing nearly enough to attract foreign capital to build private chemical fertilizer plants, the sine qua non of better food production. So the president is holding up approval of the 2 million tons of grain India says it must have by the year. For their part, Indian officials here in New Delhi do not hide their near exasperation with Washington. We have done everything we can to attract foreign capital for fertilizer plants, they say, in effect. But the American and other Western private companies know we are over a barrel, so they demand stringent terms. We just cannot meet them. Meanwhile, if the 2 million tons promised us months ago is not loaded soon, there will be a gap in the pipeline of food aid, and the consequences will be very bad indeed. One could say then that the U.S. contributed to, well, not necessarily famines. There weren't any famines post-independence in India, but the huge levels of hunger that persist, including to this day, because of deliberate withholding of food and agricultural products to India, because the Indians were their inflexible selves. They want to develop their economy. They refused to liberalize their trade, while pointing to refusal of the U.S. to liberalize its trade, especially its own agricultural sector. Well, that won't do. And the Indians, unfortunately, have a government since 1993. Either way, throughout the 90s, the Indian government has liberalized its economy, reversing many of the advances of industrial and economic development since independence, caving in, not on this occasion, to pressures in return for withdrawing food and other supplies, but the advancements of the right in India. Recently in the U.S., their former President Gerald Ford died, and it is sad that anyone dies. The rules are wrong, however, when they benefit deceit and injustice, so I will ignore those. The legacy of Gerald Ford is the destruction of the vision of America as a place where our inherent individual rights are protected. I'm sort of speaking from the American perspective, if I may, and affirmed through a government which theoretically remained in the hands of the people. Those rights depend on justice. Ford destroyed the integrity of the U.S. political system. He made a choice, and it was wrong. The choice Ford made to pardon Richard Nixon set the stage for an excruciating set of events that put Bush in the White House and have gone so far down the road to destroying the U.S. political system, which isn't unfair to say, since in the U.S., if you make a phone call, it might be monitored by the FBI. And if you borrow a book from a library, a list of the book, it will be added to a list of books that you have collected from a library by the FBI. And Nixon should have been tried. He was guilty, and Americans needed to see how their system worked overall. Instead, we've learned not to expect honesty or decency. The U.S. system has devolved into a morass that nurtures thieves and scoundrels. We today contend with a political reality that has served to elevate those in positions of public service into a class apart, guaranteeing membership in a club of privilege, an aristocracy without accountability in a republic. With those in politics, accountability is an anathema. But watch how they vote and who form. It is your rights they are selling piecemeal. A Gerald Ford, the distinguished U.S. president who we are told healed the nation in a time where the U.S. needed healing, was a man who participated in a mass slaughter in East Timor. He sent arms to our dear friend, General Suharto, who was installed in 1965. However, this was to occur just the day after he and Henry Kissinger visited Jakarta to meet their dear friend General Suharto. Otherwise, it would be embarrassing. international reporters will be asking. There are huge military operations in East Timor, and they're Indonesian. It's an attack. Don't we have a relationship with the Indonesians? Are you going to disassociate yourself with them? Are you going to tell the president, Mr. Suharto, if you don't stop this, we'll cut off aid? So it began at least maybe just the moment the airplane left for Washington, D.C., and it probably killed up to 300,000 people as the Indonesian army went on its murderous rampage from 1975 onwards. At the time, Australia was meant to have one of its most progressive national leaders, Gough Whitlam, leading the Australian Labor government, the first for decades. However, he capitulated, as I have no problem saying, and described the invasion of East Timor as a historical inevitability. I don't know if he's a Marxist, but he sounded like one on that occasion. The US since continued to support the Indonesian occupation of East Timor, however brutal it was, comparable as to being almost as bad as the genocide in Cambodia on the part of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, led by Pol Pot. However, that didn't matter, because we did it. Therefore, it's justified. The same as it was justified to gather quite a number of jihadists, or what became jihadists in the 1980s, to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. They're on our side, fighting our cause, and as Ronald Reagan described them in the 1980s, the moral equivalent of the Founding Fathers. Now, while Osama bin Laden himself was not specifically one of those he referred to, Reagan even had a few of these freedom fighters in the White House, where he has his desk, the Situation Room. I don't know if ordinary Americans would express joy if they were to hear President Bush Jr. describe Osama bin Laden and others as the moral equivalent of the Founding Fathers. Now, if we were to take a look at the policies that the Founding Fathers exercised in regards to the native population of the United States, then maybe we would express extreme recognition that is the case. There was ladies and gentlemen, a crucial test that the aspiring British Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, currently the Chancellor of the Exchequer, has found himself facing. And I'm not talking about his farce in defending multiculturalism in Britain, which was a half-hearted attempt, it would appear, on his part. I can think of more important things to discuss, like the trade policies he is defending, the Doha Round of 2002. There was a response from the British public almost immediately to Big Brother racism scandal, because one of its housemates is notoriously being, in fact, a number of them, towards the Indian celebrity who was on the show. However, that isn't to be expected as the same as the reaction to the international trade policies of leading Western states, except, especially, every time there's an international meeting of the G8 or the World Trade Organization or the IMF. The media, unfortunately, covered up the British finance minister's visit to the Republic of India. Why? Well, I believe George Orwell put it well when he wrote, I mean, everyone's heard of George Orwell. I don't think it's an unfair source to use, ladies and gentlemen. Everyone knows who George Orwell is, and almost everyone has read his book, Animal Farm. But hardly anyone has read his introductory essay to Animal Farm. The reason why is because it wasn't published. The publisher censored it, refused to allow it to be published as part of the book. unfortunately, George Orwell conceded on that occasion. And guess what the title is? Literary Censorship in England. Censorship. There are a number of interesting quotes. You go towards the middle. The sinister fact about literary censorship in England is that it is largely voluntary. Unpopular ideas can be silenced and inconvenient facts kept dark without the need for any official ban. This being kept right out of the British press, not because the government intervened, but because of a general tacit agreement that it wouldn't do to mention that particular fact. The British press is extremely centralized, and most of it owned by wealthy men who have every motive to be dishonest on certain important topics. At any given moment, there is an orthodoxy, a body of ideas, which it is assured that all right-thinking people will accept without question. It is not exactly forbidden to say this or that or the other, but it is not done to say it. Anyone who challenges the prevailing orthodoxy finds himself silenced with surprising effectiveness. The international, especially the US media, aren't critical of the neoliberal policies pursued by the World Trade Organization, the IMF, the G8. What they will criticize is the violence of the demonstrators, irrespective of it, the police who are there to maintain law and order, surely not attack the demonstrators, do so. The rout of the demonstrators at Genoa is particularly interesting. After 15 minutes of peaceful demonstration, all of a sudden, one of the leading policemen shouts, "Charge!" And the demonstrators are routed all the way out of the city. I heard a beep. If my colleagues have received phone calls from any listeners, we're ready for them. Ladies and gentlemen, we're just about to close out. Please stay tuned for more People's Question Time. Our phone numbers for calling in is on the website.